C1B 1 and 2.
Number 11A.
We have finished that first part in so far, as we have now considered the layout of that first part and have found that it has a very delicate, symmetrical, systematic layout. That this part shows being with a small b, not God as being with a capital B, but being with a small b, shows being as idea of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, each time in their seven subtones, and so we get a matrix of that whole chapter, as you have it on page 6, which just shows that if we understand those two categories, namely the category of idea versus its opposite, that's one category, and the other category, the dissolving, the way of dissolving, you have that in matrix on the top corner left. We have those two categories indicated, that's how one really unusually presents it, giving us a sense that now we can have an overall view of the chapter. Now, you can see something. If we would not have interpreted the text correctly as it is, say, if our method of interpretation would not have been scientific, but perhaps inspirational, perhaps personal, or any other method of interpretation, we would also perhaps have got a kind of interpretation, but we would not have got the matrix, which means we would not have seen that law that runs through the subtones. That would have been absolutely impossible. The law that runs through the subtones, which we now see, are actually the main thing of the of what we get out of it, would not have been visible spiritually, because the findings would not have yielded such a law. Say, if only at some parts our interpretation would have been wrong, then actually the whole matrix would not be in balance, and it wouldn't be a matrix, and therefore we would see no laws in it. So actually the result of text interpretation, therefore, is not so much that we can interpret the text in a certain way, but that scientific interpretation yields laws. That's a great point. That if we can interpret rightly, then we find something that is not spelled out black on white and printed on paper, but what we find then is the relationship. And we have started out, as you remember, that we said any structural approach is an approach where we consider relationships and not so much individual isolated facts. That we have seen when we are considering structuralism, that meaning is relational, that meaning is not in terms, in words, that terms and words have no meaning per se alone. They only gather meaning through its surroundings, so that we begin to see that only when we find the relationships in regard to the whole, that then we have a structural sense of the chapter. So I consider always interpretation as a means and not an end by itself. It is a means to find orders, to find structures, to find laws. Didn't we find that? We had a text, you see, that was rather long and taken as we used to take it atomistically. They were presenting single statements which we would consider. Single statements which we may like, which may have had a meaning for us, a certain meaning for us, Perhaps they would inspire us to a certain sense. They would even help us. They would be, in a certain case, a healing factor. So that isolated facts were always of some kind of value. But then we must see that the textbook is something more than an accumulation of individual statements. And so what did we find first? First, we found order, namely that the text is running through mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, that was the overall first melody that was running through. Then we found that within those seven subjects were always another, a second melody, a supporting melody running through, namely those subtones. And so we had already two categories at work and intertwining, interrelated, and that helped us to see the structure of the first part, the 7x7 structure, and then that structure yielded laws. That is, to my sense, the big thing. So what have we found? We found in the science of being, first, the description of being, that being constitutes of ideas of mind, ideas of spirit, ideas of soul, ideas of life, principle of life, ideas of truth, and ideas of love that we have found. We have found that these ideas have a Christ, that they have a Christ office, a saving office, namely that ideas would dispel illusions, dissolve illusions, that the Christ office. This is a healing activity that goes on in our consciousness, so to say, healing our ignorance. Healing what, really? Healing a dualistic sense of being. Because you remember always the first subtone, mind, was stating the contraposition of idea and belief without yet showing that the belief does not exist, is a nothing. It always tried to put it there as if they were two opposites, and then through the subtones, through the reasoning out, through the subtones, Mrs. Eddy would dissolve that dualistic belief to the point where at the point of the subtone of love, we always had that the idea is all and that the belief is nothing. There was always the resolving point. And so we could see that those subtones were presenting the Christ activity of an idea, because healing, the resolving, is the Christ. But she presented that Christ activity not in the Christ order. The Christ order, as you know, is principle, life, truth, love, soul, spirit, mind, as she has given it on page 115 of the textbook. So you may ask, why didn't she put the Christ order into the subtones? Why did she follow the word order? And there again, you must have enough spiritual tonality and in the categories, because she shows here the resolving of a belief through a reasoning process, through a step-by-step reasoning process, through the science of being. She reasons with the reader how that dualistic sense actually is not a dualism per se, that there are not two realities, but that there are beliefs, and reasons with those beliefs to the point where the belief gives way and says, oh, now I see that the counterfeit is not a counterfact, but a counterfeit, and therefore not the original, and therefore not the real. So the moment, naturally, she uses a reasoning process, we could also call it a process of clarifying in consciousness what is real, that is always the word order. That's not the Christ order. If she would have put it into the Christ order, those subtones, she would have had to show us something very different. She would have had to show us how the impact of an idea would really bring about the dissolution of the belief. Whereas here, it is reasoning out with the reader what he has to do step by step in order to purify his consciousness to the point of seeing the idea in its beauty, in its grandeur, in its perfection, so that there is no possibility of another concept to exist beside it. So this I wanted to bring in to show perhaps that one or the other student may have wondered why this Christ in this chapter is not presented in the Christ order, but in the word order. Because she shows the Christ to beliefs and shows how we can save ourselves from beliefs so that beliefs are no more a reality. It is how we can save ourselves from it. Another point that we may in recapitulation stress again is this, that actually, as I said, the main point that we have found is that through true interpretation we have found laws. Now this is a big thing, because laws, the law as such, what the law means, is not spelled out in the text, black and white. She did not say, look here, first in mind, I present to you the counterposition, and then in spirit I'm going to tell you that the one is real and the other is unreal, and then in soul I'm going to tell you and show you how the real is above the unreal and controls the unreal, and so on. She did not say that expressis verbis, you call it specific, now in textually, call it textually, so that one can read it with one's eye, black on white. These laws are always hidden in the text. They show themselves when the text is seen aright. It's like in nature. You only see phenomena happen. You only see that the apple falls from the tree to the ground and doesn't jump up somewhere on a higher branch or so. You always see that the book, when it goes over the edge of the table, falls down. You only see the phenomena. You don't see the formula of the law of gravitation. That is not seen. That has to be thought out. That has to be seen through the very phenomena, how they behave. And so here too, we always get this terrific thing in any text that has been written by revelation or not by by premeditated ways, but books that have been written by revelation only give us the facts, so to say, and leave it to the reader that he discovers in the text the truth. That's always like that. Why is it always like that? Because books that have a revelation within themselves have always a revelation within themselves that can be evolved through centuries and not only just to a few years. That they contain so much more than what the reader at a certain point in age can understand. They always are a much bigger treasure trove than one age can fathom, and therefore they must be written so that they contain enough hidden truth, hidden laws, that every succeeding age will find something more in it adapted to their age. This is what we have seen also when I was introducing that chapter, that we could see that an idea has a history, and that ideas are sent to humanity in a line of history, that therefore that the idea that came to Plato weren't exactly the same as the ones that came to Einstein or to Heisenberg or to Heidegger, that there is a history, and that we could see then that this idea has an inner logicity. It always brings forth that in a direct line and unfoldment which is right for an age and which an age is able to grasp and to absorb. And then another age comes in and the same text can reveal something much bigger again. Therefore, looking at the textbook, we can see that when the textbook was written, the reader could take a lot out of the textbook with that simple and inadequate method of reading it atomistically, of reading it even perhaps emotionally, of reading it religiously. He could get an enormous lot out of it until the general consciousness in the world has advanced to another level, to a level of science, of scientific thinking, and then the time is ripe to see in the same pages something new, in the very same pages something new. Then the time is ripe to approach that text in a different way, here now instead of an atomistic way, in a structural way. At the moment we have the very same text, but approaching it through a different method, that same text yields more. And so we can also see that as time goes on, there may be coming another age, perhaps in the next century or so, in which the whole consciousness of the world has matured further, and we see suddenly something completely different from a higher consciousness, and then the text may even bring forth something more beautiful than what we are at the present dreaming of. That's why we must be always ready for a paradigm shift. See, that's the great point of a scientist, that he does not fall in love with his own conception of a subject. This is one of the great sins of any scientist in any field of science, that he falls in love with the way he looks at a subject, because that narrows him. That was the first thing our professor at the university taught us, that this is a great sin. He could see that usually in our thesis or in our seminar work or so, that a student was just in love with his subject, you know, and couldn't see any more that there are also other aspects to it. And therefore what Kuhn said in his revolution, in the structure of scientific revolution, is that as a scientist we must be what he calls a mature scientist, namely a mature scientist is that scientist which is always at the point of being willing to reconsider his approach, to reconsider it, then to be willing to see anomalies in his approach, then to take those anomalies serious, that he then finds a new paradigm, therefore extraordinary science, as he calls it, a new kind of scientific approach, extraordinary science, and that rhythm should be kept up not only once in one's lifetime, but always, so that perhaps the scientist of today may go through 2-3 paradigm shifts, and that makes him a mature scientist. So also here we see now that the way I have shown you the text may be very, very different from what you were thinking about that text up to the present, and I hope it has yielded a deeper insight, a more lawful insight, a more coherent insight, so that the various statements and paragraphs now are related to each other. They find their place in a law, in a definite law, and naturally this gives us a broader sense of understanding. Therefore, scientific interpretation is creative. It is not just looking at a subject in a different way. It is meaning that true interpretation brings to the surface new insights which have not been seen and therefore are creative. And everybody wants to be creative. But he must be creative not because he wants to be creative, or as Mrs. Eddy said, that he cannot be harmonious or creative out of himself. He can only be harmonious and creative out from principle. Therefore, only then, when within himself there is that divine system of reference that creates, that brings suddenly forth that divine spark and says, can you see this? And something happens. We are not thinking out something new. We are being thought out to think something new. Now comes in that great point, why have things been unthought for a long time and then suddenly they are thought? Well, because the divine principle has an idea, and that idea has a history, has a development. It is that gentle development, that principle love, is that gentle development that brings us along a certain line, always then when we are ready as a transparency to receive it. So I hope that through this honest investigation that we have made with this chapter, we have arrived at an interpretation that has given you a new law. And it has shown us again, you see, that there are laws, but that those laws must be able to be defined. This is the great point of our age, that we should feel that we are dealing in Christian Science with laws and not with statements of truth. And when we are reading the textbook and asking what are these laws about which Mrs. Eddy speaks, the laws of God, what are they? Where can we look them up in the textbook? On which page are they written out? We do not find an answer for that. Now, nearly 400 years, it has been hidden away what the laws of God are. We only accept it by faith that there are laws, that God works according to laws. But when we were asking, tell me, what are these laws? How can you define them? What are the fixed elements of a law? Nobody could answer, or could they? No. This question was not even really put forward properly. The answer one has got was always, but my dear, God is a law. God acts according to law. There are only divine laws at work. Yes. What would we say if in mathematics we would ask, what are the laws of arithmetic? And the teacher just would say, you know, dear, in arithmetic there are laws. Could we use them? We couldn't. We must know the elements of those laws, and every law has within itself different elements, and that is, I think, what is, so to say, defining our age in Christian Science, that, say, round about from 1960 onward, we began to realize how one could define laws through divine factors. It started right out when we did the prophets and could see that each prophet was showing a different law of the Christ, that each prophet could be defined through very clearly defined elements of a law. And from that point on, it just seemed that we began to see that laws can be defined.